like you could lift a broom. Well, how you think this broom got on my shoulder, all by itself? That's what I wanted to say, but I looked at the ground. Yes, sir, but I'm a hard worker, you see. He unlocked the bolt on the door. They're cleaning muskets today. Stay out of their way. When you're done, tap on the door, and I'll let you out. I stepped inside. The door slammed. The bolt clicked. Standing there, trying to get my bearings through the gloom, I sniffed mold and linseed oil and the rancid smell of cooped-up air. Two guards were on the far side with their backs to me, taking a musket apart under one of the windows, all the pieces spread out on a table. One of them turned and said, "It's Hildy." I didn't clear up the mistake. I started sweeping. The arsenal was a single room filled with weapons. My eyes roved over everything. Kegs of gunpowder were stacked in the middle hallway to the ceiling. Arranged neat along the walls were wooden racks filled with muskets and pistols, heaps of cannonballs, and in the back, dozens of wooden chests. I kept the broom going, working my way around the whole floor, hoping the swish, swish covered the loud, ragged way my breath was coming. The guards' voices came and went in echoes. "This one could fire on the half-cock. See, the mainspring on the hammer is gone bad. Make sure the ramrod head is tight and there's no rust on it." When I was blocked from their view behind the powder kegs, my breath eased up. I got out the feather duster. One by one, I brushed the tops of the wooden chests, pausing each time to look over my shoulder before lifting the lid to peek inside. I found cow horns with leather straps, a tangle of iron handcuffs, bars of lead, pieces of thin rope, I guessed, to be fuses, but no bullet molds. Then I noticed an old snare drum propped up against the wall, and behind it was another chest. Picking my way over to it, my lame foot upset the drum, and wham-blam! It hit the floor. Here came the boot stomping. I grabbed the duster, and the feathers twitched and shook in my hand like they'd come alive. The guard yelled at me, "What was that racket?" "This drum right here fell over." He narrowed his eyes. "You're not Hildy." "No, she turned sick. I'm filling in." He had a long piece of metal in his hand from the musket. He pointed it at the drum. "We don't need that sort of carelessness in here." "Yes, sir, I'll take care." He went on back to work, but my heart had been beat to butter. I opened the chest where the drum had leaned, and there must have been 10 bullet molds inside. I pulled out 2, slow so they wouldn't clink, and stuck them in my basket under the rags. Then I swept the air clean of cobwebs and wiped down the gun racks with oil. When I had the place good as Hildy would have done it, I gathered my stuff and tapped on the door. "Don't forget the latrine," the guard at the door said, thumbing toward the rear of the arsenal. I headed back there, but I walked right past it and kept going. That night in my room, I found a little piece of cobweb in my hair. I took a towel and rubbed myself clean, then lay down on top of the story quilt, remembering the smile on Denmark's face when I'd showed up and pulled a bullet mold from my basket. When I drew out the second one, he slapped his leg and said, "You might be the best lieutenant I got." I waited for sleep, but it didn't come. After a while, I went and sat on the back porch steps. The yard was quiet. I eyed the room over the carriage house and wondered if Goodis had looked for me after supper. He would be asleep now. Denmark, too. I was the only one up, worrying about the bowl on the end of the bullet mold, the place where they pour the lead. How many people would those musket balls kill? I might have passed one of them on the street today. I might pass one tomorrow. I might pass 100 people who would die 'cause of me. The moon was round and white, sitting small at the top of the sky. It seemed the right size to sit in the bowl on the bullet mold. That was what I wished. I wished for the moon instead of lead.
Sarah. I arrived in Charleston wearing my best Quaker frock, a plain gray dress with a flat white collar and matching bonnet, the picture of humility. Before leaving Philadelphia, I'd been officially accepted into the Quaker fold. My probation had ended. I was one of them. Upon seeing me for the first time in over a year, Mother received my kiss on her cheek and said,
"I see you've returned as a Quaker. Really, Sarah, how can you show your face in Charleston dressed like that?"
I didn't like the garb either, but it was at least made from wool free of slave labor. We Quakers boycotted Southern cotton.
We Quakers? How strange that sounded to me.
I tried to smile and make light of Mother's comment, not yet grasping the full reason for it.
Is that my welcome home, then? Surely you've missed me.
She was sitting in the same spot where I'd last seen her, in the fading gold brocade wing chair by the window, and wearing the same black dress, holding her infernal gold-tip cane across her lap. It was as if she'd been sitting there since I left. Everything about her seemed unchanged, except she appeared more dilapidated around the edges. The skin of her neck folded turtle-like onto her collar, and the hair at her forehead was fraying like an edge of cloth.
"I've missed you, dear, of course. The entire household suffered because of your desertion. But you can't go about dressed like that. You would be taken at once for a Quaker, and their anti-slavery views are well known here."
I hadn't thought of this. I ran my palms down the sides of my skirt, feeling suddenly fond of my drab outfit. A voice came from the doorway.
"If that's what this hideous dress of yours means, I'll have to get one myself."
Nina. She looked like a whole new creature. She was taller, standing inches above me with her sable hair swept back, her cheeks higher, her brows thick and her eyes black. My sister had become a darkly beautiful woman. She threw her arms around me.
"You are never to leave again."
As we clung to each other, Mother muttered, as if to herself,
"For once, the child and I agree on something."
Nina and I laughed, and then astonishingly, Mother laughed, and the sound the three of us made together in the room created a silly joy inside of me.
Look at you,
I said, cupping Nina's face in my hands. Mother's eyes flitted from my collar to my hem and back.
"I'm quite serious about the dress, Sarah. One of the Quaker families here had their home pelted with eggs. It was reported yesterday in the Mercury. Tell her, Nina. Explain to your sister that Charlestonians are in no mood to see her parading around like this."
Nina sighed. "There are rumors in the city of a slave revolt."
A revolt?
"It's nothing but twaddle," Mother said. "But people are overwrought about it."
"If you believe the stories," Nina said, "the slaves are going to converge on the streets, kill the entire white population, and burn the city." The skin on my arms prickled.
"After the killing and burning, supposedly they will plunder the state bank and then raid the horses in the city stable, or else board ships in the harbor and sail off to Haiti."
A small scoff escaped Mother's throat.
"Can you imagine them devising such an elaborate plan?"
I felt a sort of plummeting in my chest. I could, in fact, imagine it. Not the part about the slaughter. That my mind couldn't fathom. But there were more slaves living in Charleston than whites. Why shouldn't they conceive a plot to free themselves? It would have to be elaborate and bold in order to succeed. And it couldn't help but be violent. Reflexively, I pressed my palms together beneath my chin as if praying.
"Dear God."
"But you can't take it seriously," Nina said. "There was a similar situation in Edgefield, remember? The white families were certain they would be murdered in their beds. It was simple hysteria."
"What's behind it, How did the rumor start?
It started with Colonel John Prelow's house slave. Apparently, he heard news of a revolt at the wharves and reported it to the colonel, who went to the authorities. The guard tracked down the source, a slave named William Paul, who's well known, apparently, for being a braggart. The poor man was arrested and is being held at the workhouse.
Nina paused, shuddering.
I can't bear to think what they've done to him.
Mother rapped the floor with her cane.
The mayor intendant has dismissed the matter. Governor Bennett has dismissed the matter. I want no further talk of it.
Just take heed, Sarah. The climate is a tinderbox.
I longed to dismiss the possibility of a revolt, too, but I felt it inside of me now, like a tidal pull.
Seeking out Handful the next morning, I found her sitting on the kitchen house steps beside Goodis, with a needle in her hand and a brass thimble on her pushing finger, hemming what looked like an apron. The two of them were snickering as I approached, giving each other affectionate little jabs. Seeing me, they ceased. Goodis leapt to his feet, and the top of his coveralls flopped down on one side. Seized by a sudden ripple of nerves over how Handful would respond to me, I pointed to where his button was missing.
You'll have to get Handful to repair that for you, I said, and regretted it instantly. It sounded bossy and condescending. It was not how I'd wanted to reunite with her.
Yes'm,
he said, and with a glance at Handful, left us. I bent over and embraced her, looping my arms about her shoulders. After a moment, she raised her arms and patted me on the sides of my ribs.
Nina said you were coming back. You staying put now?
I might. I took a seat beside her. We'll see.
Well, if I was you, I'd get back on the boat.
I smiled at her. A strip of dark blue shade draped over us from the eave, darkening as we fell silent. I found myself staring at the distorted way her foot hooked inward, at the soughing rhythm of her hands, at her back curved over her work, and I felt the old guilt. I plied her with questions, how she'd fared since I left, how Mother had treated her, how the other slaves had held up. I asked if perhaps she had a special friendship with Goodis. She showed me the scar on her forehead, calling it Mother's handiwork. She said Aunt Sister's eyesight was failing, and Phoebe did most of the cooking, that Sobby couldn't hold a candle to Tomfrey, and Minta was a good soul who took the brunt of Mrs. Nastiness. At the subject of Goodis, she merely grinned, which gave her away.
What do you know about rumors of a slave revolt? I finally asked.
Her hand grew still for a moment.
Why don't you tell me what you know about it?
I repeated what Nina had said about the slave, William Paul, and his claims of an uprising.
The officials are telling the public they're untrue, I added.
She laid the apron down.
They are? They don't believe it's true?
Her face was flooded with such relief I got the feeling the revolt was not only real, but that she knew a great deal about it.
Even if they believe such a plan exists, they would deny it, I told her, wanting her to understand the danger.
I doubt they'd acknowledge it publicly. They wouldn't want to cause a panic, or tip their hand. If they found the slightest evidence of a plot, believe me, they'll respond. She picked up the needle and thread, and the hush fell again, heavier this time. I watched her hand move up and down, making peaks and valleys, then the flash of her thimble. And I remembered us, little girls on the roof, her telling me about the true brass thimble. This same one, I imagined. I could see her lying against the roof tiles, squinting at the blur of sky and clouds, the teacup balanced on her tummy, her dress pocket stuffed with feathers, their ruffled ends poking out.
We'd spilled all of our secrets to one another there. It was the closest thing to parody the two of us had ever found. I tried to hold the picture in my mind, to breathe it back to life. But it dissolved. I didn't expect her to confide in me anymore. She would keep her secrets now. Nina and I set out by foot for the tiny Quaker meeting house on Sunday, an exceptionally long walk that took us to the other side of the city. We strolled arm in arm as she told me about the letters that had arrived at the house for weeks after my departure, inquiring about my health. I'd forgotten about the consumption story Mother had concocted to explain my absence, and Nina and I laughed about it all the way down Society Street. A fierce summer rain had swept through overnight, and the air was cool and fresh, flooded with the scent of tea olive. Pink bougainvillea petals floated on the rain puddles, and seeing them, having Nina beside me like this on such a glorious day, I felt I might re-find my sense of belonging. The past 10 days had passed in relative quiet. I'd spent the time trying to put the household back in order and having long talks with Nina, who asked endless questions about the North, about the Quakers, about Israel. I'd hoped to avoid all mention of him, but he slipped through the tiny fractures anyway. Handful had avoided me. Gratefully, nothing out of the ordinary had transpired in the city, and reports of the slave insurrection had dwindled as folks returned to the business at hand. I'd begun to think I'd overreacted about it. On this morning I was wearing my abolition clothes, as Mother insisted on calling them. As a Quaker, that was all I was permitted to wear, and heaven knows I was nothing if not earnest. Earlier at breakfast, upon learning of my intention to attend the Quaker meeting and take Nina with me, Mother had displayed a fit of temper so predictable we'd practically yawned through it. It was just as well she didn't know we'd decided to walk. Nearing the market, we began to hear the steady clomp of thunder in the distance, then shouting. As we turned the corner, two slave women broke past us, holding up their skirts and sprinting. Marching toward us were at least 100 South Carolina militia, with their sabers and pistols drawn. They were flanked by the city guard, who carried muskets instead of their typical truncheons. It was Market Sunday, a day when the slaves were heavily congregated on the streets. Standing frozen, Nina and I watched them flee in panic as hussars on horseback rushed at them, shouting at them to disperse. "What's happening?" Nina said. I gazed at the pandemonium, oddly stunned. We'd come to a standstill before the Carolina Coffee House, and I thought at first we would duck inside, but it was locked. "We should go back," I told her. As we turned to leave, however, a street vendor, a slave girl no more than 12, bolted toward us, and in her fright and panic she stumbled, spilling her basket of vegetables across our path. Instinctively, Nina and I bent to help her retrieve the radishes and cabbages and rolling potatoes.
"Step away," a man yelled. "You!"
Lifting my forehead, I glimpsed an officer trotting toward us on his horse. He was speaking to me and Nina. We straightened, while the girl went on crawling about in the dirt after her bruised wares.
"We're doing no harm by assisting her," I said as he reined to a stop.
His attention, though, was not on the turnip in my hand, but on my dress.
"Are you Quaker?"
He had a large, bony face with slightly bulging eyes that made him look more terrorizing, perhaps, than he truly was. But such logic was lost to me then. Fear and dread rushed up from my throat, and my tongue, feeble creature, lay in my mouth like a slug in its cleft.
"Did you hear me?" he said calmly. "I asked if you're one of those religious pariahs who agitate against slavery."
I moved my lips, yet nothing came. Only this terrible, silent mouthing. Nina stepped close and interlocked her fingers in mine. I knew she wanted to speak for me, but she refrained,
waiting. Closing my eyes, I heard the gulls from the harbor calling to each other. I pictured them gliding on currents of air and resting on swells of water.
"I am a Quaker," I said, the words arriving without the jerk of hesitation that preceded most of my sentences.
I heard Nina release her breath. Sensing an altercation, two white men stopped to stare. Behind them, I saw the slave girl dashing away with her basket.
"What's your name?" the officer asked.
"I'm Sarah Grimke. Who, sir, are you?"
He didn't bother to answer.
"You aren't Judge Grimke's daughter, surely?"
"He was my father, yes. He has been dead almost 3 years."
"Well, it's a good thing he didn't live to see you like this."
I beg your pardon. I don't see that my beliefs are any of your concern."
I had the feeling of floating free from my moorings. What came to me was the memory of being adrift in the sea that day at Long Branch while my father lay ill, floating far from the rope. The columns of militia had finally reached us and were passing behind the officer in a wave of noise and swagger. His horse began to bob its head nervously as he raised his voice over the din.
"Out of respect for the judge, I won't detain you."
Nina broke in.
"What right do you have?"
I interrupted, wanting to keep her from wading into waters that were becoming increasingly treacherous. Strangely, I felt no such compunction for myself.
Detain me?
I said.
"On what grounds?"
By now, a horde of people had joined the two leering men. A man wearing a Sunday morning coat spit in my direction. Nina's hand tightened on mine.
"Your beliefs, even your appearance, undermine the order I'm trying to keep here,"
the officer said.
"They disturb the peace of good citizens and give unwanted notions to the slaves. You're feeding the very kind of insurgency that's going on right now in our city."
"What insurgency?"
"Are you going to pretend you haven't heard the rumors? There was a plot among the slaves to massacre their owners and escape. That would, I believe, include you and your sister here. It was to take place this night, but I assure you it has been thoroughly outwitted."
Lifting the reins from the horn of his saddle, he glanced at the passing militia, then turned back to me.
"Go home, Miss Grimke. Your presence on the street is unwanted and inflammatory."
"Go home!"
someone in the crowd shouted, and then they all took it up. I drew myself up, glaring at their angry faces.
"What would you have the slaves do?"
I cried.
"If we don't free them, they will free themselves by whatever means."
"Sarah!" Nina cried in surprise. As the crowd began to hurl vicious epithets at me, I took her by the arm and we hurried back the way we'd come, walking quickly.
"Don't look back," I told her.
"Sarah," she said, breathless, her voice overflowing with awe.
"You've become a public mutineer."
The slave revolt didn't come that night, or any night. The city fathers had indeed ferreted out the plot through the cruel persuasions of the workhouse. During the days that followed, news of the intended revolt ravaged Charleston like an epidemic, leaving it dazed and petrified. Arrests were made, and it was said there would be a great many more. I knew it was the beginning of what would become a monstrous backlash. Residents were already fortifying their fence tops with broken bottles until permanent iron spikes could be installed. The chevaux de frise would soon encircle the most elegant homes like ornamental armor. In the months ahead, a harsh new order would be established. Ordinances would be enacted to control and restrict slaves further, and severer punishments would ensue. A citadel would be built to protect the white populace. But that first week, we were all still gripped with shock. My defiance on the street became common knowledge. Mother could barely look at me without blanching, and even Thomas showed up to warn me that the patronage of his firm would be harmed if I persisted in that kind of folly. Only Nina stood by me. And Handful. She was cleaning the mahogany staircase late one afternoon in the aftermath of the event when a rock flew through the front window of the drawing room, shattering the pane. Hearing the explosion of glass all the way on the second floor, I hurried down to find Handful with her back pressed against the wall beside the broken window, trying to peer out without being seen. She waved me back.
"Watch out! They could toss another one."
A stone the size of a hen's egg lay on the rug in a nest of shards. Shouts drifted from the street.
"Slave lover!
Nigger lover! Abolitionist! Northern whore!"
We stared at each other as the sounds melted away. The room turned quiet, serene. Light was pouring in, hitting the scattered glass, turning it into pieces of fire on the crimson rug. The sight bereaved me, not because I was despised, but because of how powerless I felt, because it seemed I could do nothing. I was soon to be 30, and I had done nothing. They say in extreme moments time will slow, returning to its unmoving core, and standing there, it seemed as if everything stopped. Within the stillness, I felt the old, irrepressible ache to know what my point in the world might be. I felt the longing more solemnly than anything I'd ever felt, even more than my old innate loneliness. What came to me was the fleur-de-lis button in the box, and the lost girl who'd put it there. How I'd twice carried it from Charleston to Philadelphia and back, carried it like a sad, decaying hope. Across the room, Handful strode into the glowing debris on the rug, bent and picked up the stone. I watched as she turned it over in her hands, knowing I would leave this place yet again. I would return north to make what life I could.
Handful. The day of retribution passed without a musket ball getting fired, without a fuse being lit, without any of us getting free. But not one white person would look at us ever again and think we were harmless. I didn't know who was arrested and who wasn't. I didn't know if Denmark was safe or sorry or both. Sarah said it was best to stay off the streets. But by Wednesday, I couldn't wait anymore. I found Nina and told her I needed a pass to get some molasses. She wrote it out and said, "Be careful." Denmark was in the bedroom of his house, stuffing clothes and money in a knapsack. Susan led me back there, her eyes bloodshot with crying. I stood in the doorway and breathed the heavy air and thought, it all came to nothing, but he's still here. There was an iron bed against the wall covered with the quilt I'd made to hide the list of names. The black triangles were laid out perfect on the red squares, but they looked sad to me now, like a bird funeral. I said to him, "So where are you going?" Susan started to cry, and he said, "Woman, if you're going to make all that noise, do it somewhere else." She pushed past me through the door, sniffling, saying, "Go on to your other wife, then." I said, "You leaving for another wife?" The curtain had been yanked closed on the window, leaving a crack on the side where a piece of brightness came in. It pointed at him like a sundial. "It's a matter of time before they come looking for me here," he said. "Yesterday they picked up Ned, Rolla, and Peter. The three of them are in the workhouse, and I don't doubt their fortitude, but they'll be tortured till they name names. If our plans live to see another day, I have to go." Dread slid down my back. I said, "What about my name? Will they say my name for stealing the bullet mold?" He sat down on the bed, on top of the dead blackbird wings, with his arms dangling by his knees. When the recruits used to come to the house, he'd shout, "The Lord has spoken to me." And he'd look stern and mighty as the Lord himself. But now he just looked cast down. "Don't worry," he said. "They're after the leader. That's me. Nobody will say your name." I hated to ask him the question, but I needed to know, what happened to the plans? He shook his head. "The thing I worried about was the house slaves who can't tell where they end and where their owners begin. We got betrayed. That's what happened. One of them betrayed us, and the guard put spies out there." His jaw tightened, and he pushed off the bed. "The day we were set to strike, the troops were built up so heavy our couriers couldn't get out of the city to spread the call. We couldn't light the fuses or retrieve the weapons." He picked up a tin plate with a candle stuck to it and hurled it at the wall. "God damn them! God damn them to hell! God!" His face twisted. I didn't move till his shoulders dropped and I felt the torment leave him. I said, "You did what you could. Nobody will forget that." "Yeah, they will. They'll forget." He peeled the quilt off the bed and draped it in my arms. "Here, take this with you and burn the list. Burn it straight away. I don't have time." "Where will you be?" "I'm a free black man. I'll be where I'll be," he said, being careful in case Rollin and them said my name after all, and the white men came to torture me. He picked up the knapsack and headed for the door. It wasn't the last time I'd see him, but those words, "I'll be where I'll be," were the last words he ever spoke to me. I burned a list of names in the stove fire in the kitchen house. Then I waited for what would be. Denmark was caught 4 days later in the house of a free mulatto woman. He had a trial with 7 judges, and before it was over and done, every person in the city, white and black, knew his name. The hearsay from the trial flooded the streets and alleys and filled up the drawing rooms and the workyards. The slaves said Denmark Vesey was the black Jesus, and even if they killed him, he would rise on a third day. The white folks said he was the frozen serpent that struck the bosom that sheltered him. They said he was a general who misled his own army, that he never had as many weapons as the slaves thought he did. The guard found a few pikes and pistols and 2 bullet molds, but that was all. Maybe Gullah Jack, who managed to stay free till August, made the rest of the arms disappear. But I wondered if Denmark had pulled the truth like taffy the way they said. When I opened the quilt so I could burn the list, I counted 283 names on it. Not 6,000 like he'd said. Nowadays, I believe he just wanted to strike a flame, thinking if he did that, every able body would join the fight. On the day the verdict came, Sabi had me on my hands and knees rolling up carpets and scrubbing floors in the main passageway. The heat was so bad I could have washed the soap off the floor with the sweat pouring down my face. I told Sabi floor scrubbing was winter work, and he said, "Well, good, you can do it next winter, too." I swear I didn't know what Minta saw in him. I had just slipped out to the piazza to catch a breeze when Sarah stepped out there and said, I thought you'd want to know. Denmark Vesey's trial is over." Of course, there wasn't a way in the world the man was getting free, but still I reached back for the banister, weak with hope. She came close to me and laid her hand on my soaked-through dress. They found him guilty. What happens to him now? He'll be put to death. I'm sorry. I didn't let on anything inside me, the way sorrow was already singing against in the hollow of my bones. It didn't cross my mind yet to wonder why Sarah sought me out with the news. She and Nina both knew I left the premises sometimes for reasons of my own, but they didn't know I went to his house. They didn't know he called me daughter. They didn't know he was anything special to me. When they gave the verdict, they also issued an edict, she said. a kind of order from the judges. I studied her face, her red freckles burning bright in the sun and worry gathered tight in her eyes, and I knew why she was out here on the piazza with me. It was about this edict. Any black person, man or woman, who mourns Denmark VC in public will be arrested and whipped. I looked away from her into the ornament garden where Goodis had left a rake and a hoe in the watering pot. Everything green was bowed down, thirsty. Everything withering. A handful, please. Listen to me now. According to the order, you cannot wear black on the streets, or cry, or say his name, or do anything to mark him. Do you understand? No, I don't understand. I won't never understand, I said, and went on back inside to the scrub brush. On July 2nd, before the sun rose, I wriggled through the window in my room, braced my back against the house, and my good leg against the wall, and shimmied up and over the fence the way I used to do. To hell with begging for a pass, white people signing their names so I could walk down the street, hell with it. I hurried through the city while I still had the darkness for cover. When I got to Magazine Street, the light broke wide open. Spying the workhouse, I stopped dead in my tracks, and for a minute my body felt like it was back inside there. I could hear the treadmill groaning, could smell the fear. In my head, I saw the cowhide slap the baby on its mama's back, and I felt myself falling. The only way I kept from turning back was thinking about Denmark, how any minute they'd bring him and his lieutenants out through the workhouse gate. The judges had picked July 2nd for the execution day, a secret everybody in the world knew. They said Denmark and five others would be put to death early in the morning at Blake's Lands, a marshy place with a stand of oaks where they hung pirates and criminals. Every slave who could figure a way to get there would show up, and white people too, I reckoned. But something told me to come to the workhouse first and follow Denmark to Blake's Lands. Maybe he'd catch sight of me and know he didn't travel the last mile of his life alone. I crouched by the animal sheds near the gate, and soon enough four horse-drawn wagons came rolling out with the doomed men shackled in back, sitting on top of their own burial boxes. They were a swollen, beat-up lot. Rolla and Ned in the first wagon, Peter in the second, and two men I never had seen in the third. The last one held Denmark. He sat tall with his face grim. He didn't see me get to my feet and limp along behind them on the side of the road. The guard was heavy in the wagons, so I had to stay well back. The horses plodded along slow. I trailed them a good ways with my foot aching inside my shoe, working hard to keep up, wishing he'd look at me. And then a strange thing happened. The first three wagons turned down the road toward Blake's Lands, but the fourth one with Denmark turned in the opposite direction. Denmark looked confused and tried to stand, but a guard pushed him down. He watched his lieutenants rumble away. He yelled, "Die like men!" He kept on yelling it while the distance grew between them and the dust from the wheels churned, and Rolla and Peter shouted it back, "Die like men! Die like men!" I didn't know where Denmark's wagon was headed, but I hurried behind it with their cries in the air. Then his eyes fell on me, and he turned quiet. The rest of the way, he watched me come along behind, lagging way back. They hung him from an oak tree on an empty stretch along Ashley Road. Nobody was there but the four guards, the horse, and me. All I could do was squat far off in the palmetto scrub and watch. Denmark stepped quiet onto the high bench and didn't move when they tugged the noose over his head. He went like he shouted to the others, like a man. Up till they kicked the bench out from under his legs, he stared at the palm leaves where I hid. I looked away when he dropped. I kept my eyes on the ground, listening to the gasps that drifted from the tree. all round, the hermit crabs skittered, looking at me with their tiny, stupid eyes, sliding in and out of holes in the black dirt. When I looked again, Denmark was swaying on the limb with the hanging moss. They took him down, put him in the wood coffin, and nailed the lid. After the wagon disappeared down the road, I eased out from my hiding place and walked to the tree. It was almost peaceful under there in the shade, like nothing had happened. Just the scuff marks in the dust where the bench had fallen over. There was a potter's field nearby. I knew they'd bury him there and nobody would know where he was laid. The edict from the judges said we couldn't cry or say his name or do anything to mark him. But I took a little piece of red thread from my neck pouch and tied it round one of the twigs on a low dipping branch to mark the spot. Then I cried my tears and said his name. Part 5, November 1826 to November 1829. Handful. It was long about November when Goodis caught a chest cough, and I headed to the stable with some whorehound and brown sugar for his throat, thinking it's another dull luster day in the world. One more stitch in the cloth. Up in the house, Mrs. and Nina were bickering. One minute it's the way Mrs. treats us slaves, next it's Nina refusing to go back to society. Without Sarah here to separate them, they kept a fight going all day. Phoebe was in the kitchen house, cooking a stew meat, getting more suggestions from Aunt Sister than she needed. Minter was hiding out someplace, probably the laundry house, and Sawby, if I had to guess, was in the cellar, smoking Master Grimke's pipe. Now that the liquor was gone, I smelled pipe smoke all the time. I slowed down by the vegetable garden to see if Goodis planted it for the winter. It was nothing but dirt clods. The ornament garden was in a shamble, too. The rose vines choking the oleander and the myrtle spurting in 20 wrong directions. Mrs. said Goodis gave Shiftless a bad name, but the man wasn't lazy. He was sick to the back teeth of forcing himself to care about her squashes and flowers. While I was studying the dirt and worrying about him, I got the feeling somebody was watching me. I looked first at Mrs.' window, but it was empty. The stable door was open, but Goodis had his back to me, rubbing down the horse. Then from the edge of my eye, I saw two figures at the back gate. They didn't move when I looked their way, just stood there in the sharp light, an old slave woman and a slave girl. What did they want? There was always a slave ready to sell you something, but I'd never seen one come peddling to the back gate. I hated to shoo them off. The old woman was bent and frail looking. The girl was holding her by the arm. I walked back there, stepping with my cane, my fingers round the rabbit head, feeling how it was smooth to the grain from all the years of holding. The woman and the girl didn't take their eyes off me. Coming closer, I noticed their headscarves were the same washed-out red. The woman had yellow-brown skin. All of a sudden, her eyes flared wide, and her chin started to shake. She said, "Handful." I came to a stop, letting the sound flutter through the air and settle over me. Then I dropped the cane and broke into a run, the closest I could get to one. Seeing me come, the old woman sank to the ground. I didn't have a key for the gate, just flew over it like crossing the sky. Kneeling down, I scooped her in my arms. I must have been shouting because Goodis came running, then Minta, Phoebe, Aunt Sister, and Sobby. I remember them peering over the gate at us. I remember the strange girl saying, "Is you handful?" And me on the ground rocking the woman like a newborn. "Sweet Lord Jesus," Aunt Sister said. "It's Charlotte." Goodis carried Mama to the cellar room and laid her on the bed. Everybody crowded in and stared at her like she was a specter. We were deer in the woods, froze to stillness, afraid to move. I felt hot, the breath gone from me. Mama's lids rolled back, and I saw the white skins of her eyes had started to yellow like the rest of her. She looked thin as thread. Her face had turned to wrinkles, and her hair had gone salt white. She'd disappeared 14 years ago, but she'd aged 30. The girl hunkered next to her on the bed, with her eyes darting face to face, her skin dark as char. She was big-boned, big-handed, big-footed, with a forehead like the full moon. She looked just like her daddy. Denmark's girl. I told Minta, get a wet rag. While I rubbed Mama's face, she started to groan and twist her neck. Sobby hauled off running to fetch Mrs. and Nina, and by the time they showed up, Mama's eyes were starting to open to the right place. The smell of unwashed bodies hung round the bed, making Mrs. draw back and cover her nose. Charlotte, she said, standing back a ways. Is that you? I never thought we would see you again. Where on earth have you been? Mama opened her mouth trying to speak, but her words scratched in the air without much sense. We're glad you're back, Charlotte, Nina said. Mama blinked at her like she didn't have the first inkling who was saying it. Nina must have been 6 or 7 when Mama disappeared. Is she in her right mind? Mrs. asked. Aunt Sister set her hands on her hips. She's wore out. What she need is food and a good long rest. Then she sent Phoebe for the stew broth. Mrs. studied the girl. Who's this? Of course, that's what everybody wanted to know. The girl drew up straight and gave Mrs. a look that could cut paper. She's my sister, I said. The room was silent. Yo, sister, said Mrs. As I live and breathe, what am I supposed to do with her? I can barely keep the rest of you fed. Nina tugged her mother toward the door. Charlotte needs rest. Let them see to her. When the door closed behind them, Mama looked up at me with her old smile. She had a big, ugly hole where her two front teeth used to be. She said, Handful, look at you. Just look at you, my girl, all grown. I'm 33 now, Mama. All that time? Her eyes watered up, the first tears I'd ever seen her shed in my life. I eased down on the bed beside her and put my face to hers. She said low against my ear, What happened to your leg? I took a bad fall, I whispered. Sobby sent everybody to do their chores while I fed Mama spoonfuls of broth and the girl gulped her straight from the bowl. They slept side by side through the afternoon. Time to time, Aunt Sister stuck her head in the dough and said, Y'all all right? She brought shortbread, castor oil boiled in milk, and blankets for a floor pallet that I reckoned would be my bed for the night. She helped me ease off their shoes without waking them. And when she saw their feet festered over with sores, she left soap and a bucket of water by the door. The girl roused once and asked for the chamber pot. I led her out to the privy and waited, watching the leaves on the oak tree drop the soft way they floated down. Mama's here. The wonder of it hadn't broken through to me yet. The need to go down on my knees. I couldn't stop feeling the shock of what she looked like, and I was worried what Mrs. might do. She looked at them like two bloodsuckers she wanted to thump off her skin. When the girl came out of the privy barefoot, I said, We need to wash your feet. She looked down at them with her mouth parted and the pink tip of her tongue poking out. She couldn't be but 13. My sister. I sat her down on the three-legged stool in the yard in the last warm spot from the sun. I brought the bucket and soap outside and stuck her feet in the water to soak. I said, How many days did you and Mama walk to get here? She had barely spoken since this morning at the gate, and now the backwash of words rushed from her lips and wouldn't stop. I ain't sure. 3 weeks? Could be more. We come all the way from Beaufort, Master Wilcox's place. We travel by night, use the footpaths the traders take, and stay to the creeks. In the daytime, we hide in the fields and ditches. This the fifth time we run, so we learn which way to go. Mama, she rubbed pepper and onion peel on our shoes and legs to muddle the dogs. She say, This time, we ain't going back. We gonna die trying. Wait now, you and Mama ran off 4 times before this and got caught every time? She nodded and looked off at the clouds. She said, one time we get to the Cumbahee River, another time to the Edisto. I lifted her feet from the bucket one at a time and rubbed them with soap while she talked. And that was something she liked to do, talk. We carry parched corn and dried yams with us, but that run out, so we eat poke leaves and berries, whatever we find. When Mom would get where she can't go no more, I'd put on my back and carry her. I'd go a ways, then rest and carry her some more. She said, if something happened to me, keep on till you find handful. The things she told me, how they drank from puddles and licked drops off sassafras leaves, how they climbed trees in the swamp and tied themselves to the limbs and slept, how they wandered lost under the moon and stars. She said one time a buckra came by in a wagon and didn't see them laying right beside him in a ditch. Came to find out she spoke Gullah, the language the slaves used on the islands. She picked it up natural from the plantation women. If she saw a bird, she'd say, there's a beady. A turtle was a cuda, a white man a buckra. I dried her feet good in my lap. You didn't tell me your name. The man who worked us in the rice fields called me Jenny. Mama said that ain't no name. She said our people used to fly like blackbirds. The day I was born, she looked at the sky, and that's what she called me. Sky. The girl didn't look like her name. She was like the trunk of a tree, like a rock in a field you plow around, but I was glad Mama had given it to her. I heard Goodis coughing in the stable and a horse whinny. When I stood, she peered up at me and said, when we was lost, she tell me the story about the blackbirds I don't know how many times. I smiled at her. She used to tell me that story too. My sister wasn't much to look at, and to hear her talk, you'd think she was too simple to learn. But I felt the toughness of Mama inside her from the start. I came awake that night on the floor pallet, and Mama was standing in the middle of the room with her back to me, not moving, gazing at the high-up window. The darkness was tucked round her, but her kerchief had slipped off and her hair was shining like fresh, polished silver. Over on the mattress, Sky was snoring loud and peaceful. Hearing me stir, Mama turned round and spread open her arms to me without making a sound. I got up and went to her. I walked right into her arms. That's when she came home to me. The next time I woke, early light had settled and Mama was sitting up in bed, looking at her story quilt. She'd been sleeping under it all night and didn't know it. I went over and patted her arm. I sewed it all together. The last time she'd seen the quilt, it was a jumbled pile of squares. Some of the color had died out from them, but a story was all there, put together in one piece. You got every square in the right place, she said. I don't know how you did that. I went by the order of what happened to you is all. When Phoebe and Aunt Sister brought breakfast, Mama was still hunched over the quilt, studying every stitch. She touched the figure on the last square, the one I knew to be Denmark. It pained me to think I might have to tell her what happened to him. The air in the room had turned frigid during the night, so I got bath water from the laundry house, where Phoebe kept it good and scalding. Sky went over in the corner and washed her thick body while I undid Mama's dress buttons. We gonna burn this dress, I said, and Mama laughed the best sound. The pouch I'd made for her hung shriveled from her neck with a new strap cut from a piece of hide. She pulled it over her head and handed it to me. Ain't much left in it now. When I opened it, a moldering smell drifted out. Digging my finger inside, I felt old leaves ground to powder. Mama sat low on the stool while I pulled her arms out of the dress sleeves and let the top drop to her waist, showing the grooves between her ribs and her breasts shrunk like the neck pouch. I dipped a rag in the basin, and when I stepped round to wash her back, she stiffed up. She had whip scars gnarled like tree roots from the top of her back down to her waist. On her right shoulder, She'd been branded with the letter W. It took me a minute before I could touch all that aching sadness. When I finally set her feet in the basin, I asked, "What happened to your teeth?" "They fell out one day," she said. Sky made a sound like, "Hmm." She said, "More like they got knocked out." "You don't need to be talking. You tell too many tales," Mama told her. The truth was, Sky would tell more tales than Mama ever knew. Before the week was out, she'd tell me how Mama set loose mischief on the plantation every chance he got. The more they whipped Mama, the more holes she'd cut in the rye sacks. She broke things, stole things, hid things. Buried the threshing sickles in the woods, chopped down fences, one time set fire to the overseer's privy house. Over in the corner, Sky wouldn't let go of the story of Mama's teeth. "It happened the second time we run. The overseer say if she do it again, she'd be easy to spot with her teeth gone. He took a hammer." "Hush up," Mama cried. I squatted down and stared her in the eyes. "Don't you spare me. I've seen my share. I know what the world is."
Sarah. Israel came to call on me, wearing a short, freshly grown Quaker beard. We were seated side by side on the divan in the Mott's parlor, and he stroked the whiskers constantly as he talked about the cost of wholesale wool and the marvels of the weather. The beard was thick as velvet brush fringe and peppered with gray. He looked handsomer, sager, like a new incarnation of himself. When I'd returned to Philadelphia after my disastrous attempt to resume life in Charleston, I'd rented a room in the home of Lucretia Mott, determined to make some kind of life for myself, and I suppose I'd done that. Twice weekly, I traveled to Green Hill to tutor Becky, though my old foe, Catherine, had recently informed me that my little protege would be going away to school next year, and my tutoring would end at the first of the summer. If I was to stay useful, I would have to seek out another Quaker family in need of a teacher. But as yet, I hadn't made the effort. Catherine was kinder to me now, though she still drew herself up tight as a bud when she saw Israel smile at me at meeting, something he never failed to do. Nor did he fail in his visits to me, coming twice each month to call on me in the Mott's parlor. I looked at him now and wondered how we'd gotten ourselves stranded on this endless plateau of friendship. One heard all sorts of rumors about it, that Israel's two eldest sons opposed his remarriage, not on general principle, mind you, but specifically to me, that he'd promised Rebecca on her deathbed he would love no one but her, that some of the elders had counseled him against taking a wife for reasons that ranged from his unreadiness to my unprovenness. I was not, after all, a birthright Quaker. In Charleston, it was being born into the planter class that mattered. Here, it was the Quakers. Some things were the same everywhere.
"You're the most patient of women," Israel had told me once. It didn't strike me as much of a virtue.
Today, except for the newness of his beard, Israel's visit gradually began to seem like all the rest. I twiddled with my napkin as he talked about merino sheep farms and wool dyes. There was the clink of teacups when the silence came, children's voices overheard mingled with racing footsteps on creaking floors, and then, abruptly, without preface, he announced, "My son Israel is getting married." The way he said it, quiet and apologetic, embarrassed me.
Israel? Little Israel?
He's not so little now.
He's 22.
He sighed, as if something had passed him by. And I wondered absurdly if there was a Quaker law forbidding fathers to marry after their sons. I wondered if the beard was not so much a new incarnation as a concession. When it was time to say goodbye, he took my hand and pressed it against the dark whorls of hair on his cheek. He closed his eyes, and when he opened them, I felt he was about to say something. I lifted my brows. But then, releasing my hand, he rose from the divan and, whatever errant thought,